The idea is you get out of North Ministry, you start your journey, you become a journeyman.
That's the idea.
Okay, let's stay high level, okay? You're getting into too much detail.
Okay.
What changed? Why are you back?
He just kept begging me to come back and like, dude, all right.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. Today we are inside the lantern of the Old North Church. So Brock has generously helped us out in getting this location, and he's going to help us be a source of information where we are lost little puppies. And Brock has been on this tour many times. You're on the board of the Old North Church of some sort, right?
The Preservation Committee.
Right. This is the One If By Land, Two If By Sea Church. And then I'll just stop talking because I don't know what I'm talking about.
So this is what we're technically in is called Christ Church.
Okay.
It becomes Old North because it's the oldest church in the north end of Boston. At the time of a lot of its historical significance, Battle of Bunker Hill, April of 1775, this is called Christ Church. And it's a loyalist church. It is Episcopal. It's
loyalist to who?
To the crown.
Okay.
Yeah. It's loyal to the crown.
We should probably leave.
This neighborhood in particular is the heart of Boston. It's the heart of traditional colonial Boston, and it's very much the loyal center. Paul Revere's house is here, and he went to a church over closer to where he lived that was more open to dissent from the crown.
So he didn't live there. That was just his shop.
He lived there.
The
house that's over in North Square, he lived there, but he didn't go to church here.
That wasn't his first house either, so he would have been out in the countryside before.
Okay.
But then he moved into the city later on.
Yep, he lived there for, I hope I get this right, 16 years or so. And it was similar to how it looks now, and it was restored then by Joseph Chandler. It had 3 stories and lots of changes to it. Chandler took it down to what they believed would be a close approximation to what it looked like when Revere's family lived there.
And nice. Chandler's the first preservation carpenter, and we've talked about him before, but he kind of took creative liberties with a lot of his stuff to kind of
like early preservation movement.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, so 1930s, the first
good preservation.
Yeah.
It was good preservation for the time.
Right, exactly.
It was based on the knowledge they had, which now through a lot of our dendrodating work and paint analysis and spectroanalysis, you can look at it and go, okay, this wasn't right. There were some jumps made here based on other houses, which ties into this structure we're in now. This church we're jumping ahead quite a bit, but in the 19-teens and 20s, in the 1912 renovation, the colonial revival period is hot and heavy, and they look at this church and say, okay, based on its time period and its age and the congregation that was here, we believe this would have been much more Puritan looking. And so that's when it got its whitewash paint on the inside.
Oh, cool.
That's when a lot of the architectural detail is covered or removed from the structure, especially on the inside, which if we go downstairs back into the space, the main interior space, you'll see that they've started uncovering a lot of the murals that were on the building.
Oh, really?
That were on the inside of the hall.
Nice.
In the beginning.
So this structure is, I think, just so awesome. One, it's fallen down 3 times. So this is not the original
2 times.
Structure.
We're in number 3.
Wait for number 3.
don't jinx it.
Fallen down twice. Okay, yeah, just twice.
From a hurricane, you said?
Two hurricanes.
2 hurricanes.
Well, I think I see something coming.
the Great Gale of... Oh, shoot.
Someone fact check him.
1854.
Nice.
Took the tower down, and it was rebuilt it was rebuilt based on designs from Charles Bullfinch.
Nice.
And it didn't look anything like original. There are some photos of it downstairs, but it was rather different looking than it was originally. In 1950, I might have gotten that first date wrong. In 1954, it blows down for the second time, and it lands right there.
Between the street, between the
buildings on the street.
Directly
on the street right there. Yep, it lands right there.
Wow.
Completely misses the buildings around it and lands. And the top courses of brick are taken down. They find, through church records, a church in New Hampshire, I believe, that was based on this one. They got the plans from Old North and built a church up in New Hampshire that would be a replica. And so the carpenters and architects went up and took measurements of that tower and then replicated it back
no
here.
Way. I heard the rumor that it's possible Christopher Wren had designed this church originally.
That's not what I've seen. What I've seen is it's designed, especially the interior, off of his churches that were, because he did, well, 60 churches or something in London after the fire of 1666. Yep. And so the architect Price, William Price, the first designs Old North, studied Christopher Wren's churches after the Great London Fire and designs this one after the St. Andrew by the Wardrobe in Blackfriars, London. Hmm. And so when you look at the interiors, they're very similar. Exteriors are not similar, but the interiors are very similar to each other. And that's a Christopher Wren building.
Okay, so yeah. That's where that...
Yeah, that's where the tie-in is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Price was very much impacted by Christopher Wren's work in London.
There was a Price who had a pattern book. It wasn't that Price.
No, I'm not sure.
Francis Price or something?
This is... No, this would be William Price. There was William Price, and there's another architect to work with him. William Price is the name that sticks in my head.
Okay.
That worked on this.
So this structure is just so mind-boggling to me because I think it points out the level of craftsmanship that existed years ago, right? The 1727, I think, is the original year of this.
23. But it isn't finished for 26 years or so.
But that's
the 1740s is when it's fully finished.
That's pre any form of industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
The only things that they have working on this is sawmills and other stuff like that. I mean, they're not getting their crane out and lifting up these steeples. This is a open steeple, just wide open to the elements, to the weather, to everything. People passing up giant timbers. I mean, look at some of these timbers that we've got in this. You can see the hewing marks on some of them. Like, what in the world?
This is 1950.
1950s, but probably built to mimic the original. So there is hewing in this structure. There's also a lot of metal bracket and bolting. And there's a lot of extra framing in here that probably wouldn't have been in its original structure. There's quite a bit more braze. It's had some fire. There's been a little bit of fire here or there.
But you know what I'm saying? Like this, you know, obviously we're not standing in the original one of the three that have fallen down, but...
No, it's amazing that they could build something this tall at that time.
And
maybe,
this is,
maybe that's naivety about how good they were.
This is shorter.
Yeah.
It went this is 176 and the original was 191.
Right.
So this is actually almost 20 feet shorter than it was in 1740 when it was put up. Yeah.
Come on. Like, that's crazy.
That is nuts.
The church is opened in 1723. It's December 29th or something is the first service in 1723. But there was no steeple. It was just the nave or celebratory space downstairs. There's a pew downstairs dedicated to the Logwood men. It was a group called the Gentlemen of the Bay of Honduras that donated logwood, which was a species of lumber from Belize that was used for dyeing and printing. They donated proceeds from that to start the campaign to build the tower, to build the steeple. But by 1736, they started a subscription service to get the rest of the money. And so then in 1740, they actually build the steeple.
Wow.
So 1740, 1744 is when this steeple is actually added on
to
the church.
So just quick things, I think this is right, you can correct me, but the very first, like, the model for this form, okay, where you have basically a temple form and then a steeple, is James Gibb, St. Martin's in the Field in London, and he basically takes a Greek temple and puts a steeple on it, and that's why we have steeples on these kind of Greek temple-looking buildings.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times, the steeple was based off of the width of the actual building, what's the base called, the nave?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
That's one of those practical geometry things where they would...
The height of the steeple being based on the length or the width in golden ratio.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. Yeah, so I guess I'm kind of geeking out because I'm seeing, and I asked Michael this in a different episode, like preservation sophistication or just, like, I'm looking at the windows, and it's not a Georgian profile. It's a much thicker window than it would have been. If this blew down tomorrow and you're on the committee to restore it, what changes would you make to the way you do it? Would you build it more accurately, or would you, you know, it looks like those aren't wood, they're metal.
I'm that's a loaded question. I'm a graduate.
Am I going to get you in trouble?
No, but I'm a graduate from the preservation program. So, of course, I want this to go back to as close to 100% accuracy as possible.
Well, that's what I agree. And that's what I'm saying. I'm like we would do it different. And so, the right? I mean, you'd do the sash different. You'd probably do the framing different.
Yeah. I mean, I would. Maybe. The difficulty would be finding the detail of what this framing should have looked like. But yeah, I mean, there are exceptions we'd have to make to it for fire and other issues. But yeah, I would love to see this back. Exactly.
Well, this is kind of a geeky preservation thing. Like, would you build it in steel so that it stays up forever and then skin the outside so that it looks right? I mean, you know, or would you, you know, go back knowing that you're building something that's not going to be as strong? It's blown down two times.
Knocking on wood.
You know where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way Notre Dame was handled,
right,
is
okay,
kind of the gold standard.
Yeah.
Because they had a full digital rendering, somehow, happenstance had just completed that before the fire. They knew everything about the inside of that structure and could completely replicate it down to irregularities in the timber and errors in the joinery. And that's fantastic. That's what I'd love to see. I'd love to see this go back to as absolutely perfect a replication of 1740 as it could be.
That kind of goes to the question, though, where Notre Dame stayed up for 500 years? How old is Notre Dame? Like,
Notre Dame was started 1300?
So that's 700, 800 years?
11?
900 years? 1,000 years. That's 1,000 years since that structure has stood. That's crazy. And so, of course, we would build Notre Dame back to that. But this steeple's fallen down 3 times. Does that change your preservation ethic? Does that change from a preservation work to a restoration work, or have some of those steel beams inside? Where
I think the complexity of this building and the inherent weaknesses makes you pause and think about it differently. Because I agree with you, it'd be great as an exercise to rebuild exactly, but I'm like, is that the smartest thing to do?
Yeah, I can't. I could not condone rebuilding it 100% if we know that it's just going to fall over again.
Right, right.
But there are things that were done in it in the 50s, in the 1950s, a lot of heavy metal bracketing, a lot of bolting, that we could probably come up with a more elegant solution for that now that would blend and hide and still achieve the hurricane resistance and hold down that we need on the structure without making it look like we used a bunch of modern fasteners to hold something together that wouldn't have had any of that.
Yeah.
Well, let's
wait,
keep going.
Let me ask one other question.
Well, again,
the history. Okay, they're right across the river there. That's Charleston. That's where they got. That's where the British landed. Is that right? No, that's
from when the lanterns were lit.
Yeah, when the lanterns were lit.
So April 18th, 1775, that evening, Robert Newman and Captain John Pulling Jr. came up. Newman was a sexton in the church, and Pulling was a vestryman. So they were both members of the congregation, but they were patriots, not loyalists. And so they sneak in, they come up, and they light two lanterns. They sneak in, they come in through a window called the Newman window that was bricked over.
No way.
They sneak into the back of the church because there are curfews in the neighborhood and British patrols. And so they sneak in, they climb up here.
Wait, there's British patrols in Boston at that time?
Boston is under siege at that point.
Oh, it is.
It
okay.
is.
I don't think I knew that.
The British are here, and the colonial militia under General Washington is forming and coming up. So I'm sorry, Bunker Hill is when it's under siege. The British are here. The British are in Boston. It's not under siege yet. That's not until June 1775.
But they still had troops marshaled in the area.
But the British have landed here. They're in Boston. They're patrolling the city, knowing that there is dissent.
Right, okay.
And so it was still a colony at the time, so they still had presence.
So Newman and Pulling sneak in. They scamper up here. They light the two candles, the two lanterns, from here so that Charlestown can see it, to let them know that one is by land, two is by sea. It's by sea at that point. And today we look at it and go, what do you mean?
Yeah, where?
All I need is a canoe. But that's filled in
right.
significantly. The British warships could harbor
That was a question there. I was going to ask. Yeah.
Logan Airport.
When you look at, there's like topographical maps of Boston where they've got like what it was in 16, whatever, whenever they found it, 1610, and then what it becomes and what it is today.
Yeah.
What are we standing on right now? Has this been this is
original.
Granted? Okay, this is
this
original.
Is original Boston.
Nice.
But the harbor this probably is closer. I mean, you see the water there.
It's probably extended a little bit.
So that's the away. That's the Coast Guard station back there, the North End Coast Guard station. So if you came back to the main street that's just before the Coast Guard station, that's where the harbor would have been.
Yeah. Wow.
And it is pushed out from Cambridge significantly as well.
Okay.
So it took serious boat power to get all of the British over there. So it really was kind of by sea. It took them 30-40 minutes to row boats across full of troops and then to marshal up on the other side and then start their march out on the Boston Post Road.
So they're these guys are signaling who?
They're signaling people in Cambridge to let them know they're going to come across via Cambridge. So send riders from Cambridge out to Concord and Lexington to Concord to let them know that they are heading to go and try and catch and capture the
gunnery or whatever.
Yeah, there are cache piles of powder and arms and cannon in Concord. And so that's what the British are going to go and collect.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not just Paul Revere who makes that ride.
There are three people.
Okay.
Yeah, William Dawes, Paul Revere, and
another guy.
There's a third guy.
Yeah. The really famous one.
There's a third guy. Only one of them makes it.
Yeah.
Two of them, Dawes and Revere, are caught.
No.
Revere is actually caught fairly quickly. They ride out from Boston, out through the Boston Neck, through Roxbury, and then try and get around
up to Concord.
And they're heading out to let other towns know, hey, there's something happening. Let your militias
gather the troops. Yeah.
That's some next level trolling to come up in their church and light the lantern.
And then they scamper back down because it's seen. The whole town sees it.
For sure.
Oh, right.
This is the tallest structure in Boston. Yeah. And so the whole town sees it. And they get back down and go out through the window in the back and escape and get out into the neighborhood.
That's pretty cool.
So cool. All
right. That's April 1775. This has another significance to it, though, in June 75. June 1775 is the Battle of Bunker Hill. The Battle of Bunker Hill, you can see the Bunker Hill Monument
out there.
That battle, which is actually on Breed's Hill, not Bunker Hill. Breed's Hill is closer to Boston, and so that's why they set up on Breed's Hill. General Gage, who's in charge of the British forces in Boston at the time, is stationed in Boston. At this point, Boston is now under siege. The colonial militia, the colonial army is here. They're headquartered in Cambridge. They take up positions at Breed's Hill and at Dorchester Heights so that they can point cannon down into the city of Boston. So Boston is now cut off, and the British are forced to have to leave Boston. But in the Battle of Bunker Hill, General Gage has lookouts up here directing the cannon fire, which is being fired from Copse Hill, which is right there. The Copse Hill burial ground is where the British artillery was set up. And so General Gage has either himself or people up here telling them where to aim the cannon fire to make it across the river, because Breed's Hill is just close enough they can shoot at it from here.
Wow.
If the colonialists had set up on a Bunker Hill, they would have been out of cannon range in both directions. They couldn't have shot into Boston.
Yeah.
And Boston couldn't have shot to them.
Oh my God.
Changes so they moved the scale to Breed's of the Hill, city. It's just so much smaller.
You're talking 12-pound, 16-pound cannon being fired from here over the river, over the bay into Bunker Hill, to the Battle of Bunker Hill.
It serves two
major historical points for the start of the revolution. Not just the lanterns.
Wow. I didn't even know about that second one. That's really cool.
All right.
Well, let's keep going. There's a lot more I see in this church.
It's a pretty wild spot. And you can see, if you look across that way, she should still be at her birth. The USS Constitution's right across.
Right there, yeah.
There she is. Old Ironsides is sitting in harbor. Yeah, that's where she lives at the Charlestown Navy Yard. And there is that's open to the public. It's an active
I've been on it. Yeah.
So it is the world's oldest active Navy ship.
No way.
And it's still still technically commissioned.
Yeah.
It's staffed by the U.S. Navy, and it is open free to the public to go and check it out.
Yeah, that was cool.
That's sweet. All right, so we're back here. We've come down a story. I really am stopping the progress here because I want to talk about kind of the reproduction idea that we're seeing here. These are circular sawn beams. So traditionally, they would have been a timber like hewn out pit sawn or something, maybe through the sawmill at that time, but they then hand hewn down to, you know, whatever they would have been. No longer. It's circular sawn, you know, 1900s is when this addition was done. This one is a reproduction timber, and I say reproduction because Brock and I were talking about it, and it doesn't show any signs of scalloping. It doesn't show any...
What's scalloping, Jackson?
It doesn't show any signs of going across the grain of the wood here, because essentially when you would have been hewing something like this, you would be, it would be on its side on the ground, and you'd be standing like this, you know, if I'm in plane with the board, you know, cutting alongside of the face of it, cutting down into the ground, right?
With what?
With a broad axe. Great point. Because these look like they've been adzed out because the
What's an adz?
How about you explain it?
No, you're explaining it, but you're throwing out all these North Bennett Street terms.
All right, so an adz is like an axe with, how would you explain an adz?
It's a green woodworking tool similar to an axe. So an adz,
the blade's the other way.
It's yeah, so the bit on an axe or the cutting edge is parallel with the handle.
Yeah.
And an adz, it's perpendicular to it. And they tend to be, they could be slightly scooped.
Yeah.
So that as you cut down, you're swinging it like this in front of you. Usually you're standing on or straddling whatever it is you're cutting, and you're scooping chips that are running lengthwise. They're running with the grain. So they would be running. The motion would be going with the length of the timber.
So you'd be standing here, and instead of adding this face of it, because it's perpendicular to it, you're scooping out from here. And so that's all the marks that we're seeing here. Now, that's not how you hew timbers. That's not how you do it, because it leaves behind exactly these scoop marks that we're seeing, when traditionally you would leave behind like a scallop mark, which is that curvature of the broad axe, the head of the broad axe, and then the slight sweep of the blade there. It would come and make a pass alongside it, and because of the sweep of your arms, it would be like a downward curving sweep along the face of these boards, and you're supposed to do one in front, one behind, and then one in the middle, and it leaves a lot flatter of a surface. And if it's a show face, a lot of times it's planed afterwards. So seeing that.
The reason he's geeking out to that is these are dating tools. This is the way that you look and you say, this looks original, this doesn't. And it goes into the, whether it's the
first period.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of when they would have done it. He's talking about circular sawn. He's talking about pit sawn. It's just like when I explained that we took moldings off the wall and looked what kind of nails they were, or wire nails or cut nails or wrought nails. They're all dating tools. So,
and then if you see on this other one, it actually looks like it's properly scalloped, and it actually looks like it was broad axe hewn, that one in the far side. So, yeah, anyway, that just want to speak very shortly about that, but that one looks closer to correct. These ones look very
and
wrong.
And so in 54, when they did this, he's just saying it's interesting for him, not for anybody else, but for him to look at these tool marks and go, oh, cool, that's what they did.
Yeah, just briefly wanted to talk about this room, mainly because of these windows. You can see the brick coursing here. We were in Salem yesterday, so a couple episodes ago, talking about the Flemish bond in the brick layering. This is an English bond. Actually, this wall might be better to look at it, because you can see how these courses are alternating. You see the butt ends of the brick here and then the wide ends of the brick there. And so this is how they would tie these courses in together, by having, you know, the flats lay on top of the butt ends, and then the butt ends extend out into the next one. So they've got another flat on top of that, and it's tying this whole building together. They've got I was made fun of in Salem the other day by these
rightly
for,
so
for these terms that I'm using, but it's called wide, W-Y-T-H-E. How many bricks wide the thing is? It's 11 wide at the bottom. And then as it goes up, they move inwards every so often. So that we're up at like the highest level of the brickwork in the building. And so this is the 9 wide course of bricks here. And then as we get down to the base, it's 11 wide, and it's 2.5 feet. Is that what you said?
2.5 feet, yeah.
2.5 feet it's thick.
Somewhere on the number of just over 513,000 bricks.
Right. 513,000 bricks, 500,000 bricks. And it's most of these are original. If not all.
So we were talking upstairs, and Jackson ruined it, but we were talking about the color of the thing, and you had brought up that this would have originally been lime washed, and now it's red.
Yeah.
And why would they have made that? Like, why would they have lime washed it?
The brick in the colonial period for the U.S. colonies is good brick. It's being made out of clay. That's not too bad. There aren't too many impurities in it, but it's still a fairly soft brick.
Because it's fired and they can't get it.
Yep. The way it's fired, you're creating long tunnels of the brick. And putting a fire down through the middle of that, and the brick at the middle of that closest to the fire is going to get really, really hard and be used on the exteriors of the structures. And then the softer bricks on the outside will be, if they're capable of being structural, will be used toward the inside of the structure, or they'll be used for brick nogging insulation if they're too soft.
And that color striation is why you see that.
Is from the different impurities in the brick and from the different placement. Yeah, the darker colors that are almost shiny will be closer to the fire. The softer clay colors will be toward the outside. They didn't get fired as hard. There wasn't as much smoke and as much heat against them. But you're gonna still have a brick that is very susceptible to freeze-thaw cycles in New England climates. These bricks would have been painted over on the outside of the structure with a lime paint. Whether they were white, you could use natural pigments, so whites and greens and yellows and reds to color the paint when you're painting the outside of the building. And it would have been put on in the beginning, 24 coats of it. It's very, very thin, 24 coats would be put on, and then it wears away, and every so often you'd paint more coats onto it. But if you wanted a building that was red, you'd paint it red. It wasn't exposed red brick, especially not on a structure like Old North Church Faneuil Hall.
Yeah.
Maybe a shed behind your house or an ancillary accessory building would have been left exposed, but not something as important as Christ Church, Faneuil Hall, any of the other historical structures in Boston that were prominent buildings that had a lot of money going into them and their construction. They would have been protected from the weather by making sure they were painted.
You were saying that Faneuil Hall was sandblasted at some point. This goes back to that bad preservation, right? Just not knowing.
Yeah, good intentions, right? Bad research or lack of research. And these buildings such as Faneuil Hall being sandblasted in the early 20th century, in the 19-teens, to remove paint off the outside that was considered to be inaccurate to the origin of the structure. Well, it might not have been inaccurate. It might have been the wrong kind of paint. Or the wrong color, but it probably was painted to protect the brickwork. If you wanted a building that was brick, that looked like brick, you'd paint it red, and then you'd hire a crew of people called liners that would come through with lead white paint, and they would paint the mortar lines to make it look like a red brick building.
And that happens actually even later into like some of the courthouses and some of the buildings we've done. We've seen the mortar
lead line.
Yeah, just treated differently so that it kind of pops and looks different.
And it was a way of making a building that may not have been a very expensive building look more expensive by having larger looking bricks. It wasn't that the brick was larger. The mortar line that was struck was really crisp and clean and tiny. But then you get close enough and you realize, oh no, the mortar line's actually a half of an inch, not a quarter of an inch.
Right.
And the bricks are actually smaller than what they appear to be. But it was a little bit of a facade look to make it look like, kind of like rustication of siding, to make it look like stone, to make different stones look like more expensive stone, or to make wood look like stone. Just another one of those methods used to make a building look more impressive or more expensive than it might have been. Awesome. But that was all done through paint and line and effort.
That hall that you're talking about, what's it called? Faneuil Hall?
Faneuil Hall, yeah.
I walked by that last night and I saw the moldings on the outside are like destroyed.
Yeah.
Is that from sandblasting?
It may have some traces back to the sandblasting, but it's also just a lack of proper maintenance.
I was like, holy Bondo. It looks crazy.
It, like many buildings that are, especially buildings that are owned by municipalities, there's just not a lot of funding. Dang. To give them the proper care and maintenance that they would have had originally, but can't get it now.
Yep.
All right, so here we are inside of the actual chapel. The nave, is that the proper word for it? I don't know.
That's the word we're going with.
Well, the nave, and inside here, you see all of these boxes that are laid out throughout here. These would have all been purchased as like a donation to the church. every year, every month or some
odd. You would have paid annually and weekly.
Yeah, to have your name and your box reserved. If you were part of the riffraff, you'd go upstairs where there isn't reserved boxes and everyone looked down upon you to see the who's who of the town. Because attending church was a lot more common of a practice back then, where this was the gathering space, this was the meeting space of everyone. And so we're going to do another episode in King's Chapel, and that was another real who's who of whatever, and that's a big emphasis that we're going to see there as well. But just looking around, this archway above us, the giant thing, was all done in brick, correct? Covered in plaster?
Covered in plaster, yep. Yep. This is, it would truss. It had wooden trusses above it, and then a wooden plaster ceiling above us in here.
Remember I said yesterday we were looking at that, not yesterday. Remember I said in the other episode on Salem?
It was yesterday to you.
How the column went up on that porch, and then you had the architrave, and then the frieze, and then it went to the cornice. That's, and I said, sometimes in churches, well, here we are in a church, and they have that exact detail. So pretty cool. And this is 1724, right? So you're seeing raised panels, right? This isn't a federal, this is a early Georgian building. And so even the way they raised the panels on that thing is an earlier way of doing that. The moldings are big and hefty in this place. They're not light and dainty, so yeah.
These massive windows.
I know. Is that an original window? Is that why that's covered up?
That's an original window.
It is.
That was bricked over. And then during a renovation I think that's during the 1912 renovation, they uncover that. And that's the window
they snuck through?
When they got out of the building. They went through that window, and that window is believed to be an original window and sash to the structure.
Wow, that's really cool.
That's very cool.
And then all these others are modeled after that one?
The others in here are...
Because it was expanded in like 1850-something?
It was, and these windows, if I'm correct on this, these windows were done by North Bennett Street students.
Oh, sweet.
So it was expanded which way? How is this expanded?
No. The windows were
the
expanded.
The height of the windows, I see. Very cool.
This is
because you think they're all that size going around?
Yeah, closer to that size, yep.
Oh, interesting.
This design inside, the columns with the paneled second story, the gallery story, and then continuing the columns up, this is what looks a lot like the Wren Church in Blackfriars, St. Andrew of the Wardrobe. This is what, if you look in that, it has paneled lower, they're wooden paneled walls below the gallery, but that paneled course looks very similar to that, and the columns above into the archways.
So just classically, you have, the portions aren't perfect, but you do have a column supporting a pedestal, right, then supporting the column going up. So there is that column is wider at the bottom, supposed to be stronger to carry that load as it goes above. So you're seeing that transfer of weight and the scale drop down. So good classicism.
Any other details you want to jump around and look at?
Oh, I want to go look at that window a little closer.
The piece that's really important to me to look at when we talk about preservation work and trying to be as accurate as possible are the murals. Yeah. The cherubs. The heat's kicking on. The cherubs that are up in these archways are original to 1720s.
You think there would have been more murals in here?
Yeah. There are photos from... they're upstairs. I think they're from the 1860s that show painted banding up through the arch, up through the ceiling and in each of the archways. If you look up
makes sense.
I think that second archway over there, there's some of the banding is uncovered up in the ceiling.
That makes sense.
In the 1912 renovation is when they painted over everything, thinking that it should have looked more Puritan in here, more white. Which is inaccurate. There would have been lots of murals, lots of painting. The color that they've painted up there, that kind of tannish color, they think that's what would have been the larger color palette in here because it would have made, they wanted it to look like stone. And so stone and frescoes inside the church. You can see there's a pew over there that's completely velvet lined. Yeah. That's what the box pews would have looked like because you were allowed to put in curtains and cushions and you would have had heaters and carpet to make it comfortable because you were in here for a Sunday service all day.
Yeah.
Their services weren't an hour and a half, 2 hours. They were an all day affair. And so you would wanted to be comfortable, and it was very cold in here in the winter. So there were heaters inside the box pews. If you were of a lower socioeconomic class, or if you were enslaved, you would have been in the top, in the galleries. And that was a space where you could rent for a lower cost, or your benefactors could pay for you to have a space in the galleries upstairs. But the galleries were incredibly cold.
Yeah. You had to pay to come to church?
You had to pay for the pew. Yeah, you had to pay for your, it was part of your ability to help support the financial cost of the church.
Okay.
Yeah.
So some interior designer came in and said, let's paint this. Pretty much what happened.
The architectural historians of the time said this is inaccurate.
So the whole white paint thing is pretty fascinating to me, because they wouldn't have actually had white early on, or as much.
Or lead white, but it would have been expensive.
It would have been expensive. And so the yellows and the browns we were looking at yesterday, at the last episode on Stunt, where those browns and umbers and different things like that, that reminds me of that kind of palette color better. And so it's funny, I think...
And arsenic would have been green.
Yeah, I think Michael told me, Burry said that whole New England is a white town and things like that is an 1820s, 1850s thing, when white lead became more available and people would paint it white. Which is interesting, right? And then by 1912, they're looking back at 1850, go, "Oh, that's how we are."
Yeah, that's how it should look. And they're also looking at, this is the most prominent church in Boston at one point. They're looking at Puritan churches from the 1720s and 30s and 40s that might have been small communities outside of Boston, and said, "Well, that's what Puritan churches look like. This is Puritan. Let's make this thing look white." No, wrong. Not at all. Right. This was the youngsters' church.
Yeah.
King's Chapel, where you're going to see...
Old money.
That's... King's Chapel is from the 1660s, I think.
Yeah.
Originally. Not that structure.
Yeah.
But originally. And so it's where old money, where the older families and older parishioners went. This was started by younger parishioners. And so they would have wanted this place to look fantastic. They were coming into new money. They were industrialists from the shipping industry. And they would have wanted this to be, you know, a statement of their faith and of their community, and not this plain, stark white look.
That's so interesting.
My favorite part about the murals is that they were able to pull back all of the white paint because they never cleaned them. They just painted white right over the dirt that was on them from all of the candles, all the soot and everything. And so the curators, the paint analysis people came in and just started scrubbing it away with a really light paint remover, and said, "This is, we don't even have to do much for this. It just comes right off."
Isn't that crazy?
And then they're putting a lacquer over it before they restore it, so that there's a layer between the original and their restoration work, so that at some point somebody wanted to later on, they could pull all the restoration work right off.
Oh, that's really cool.
So they're sealing the original with something that can be removed, and then putting their restoration work on top of that. Because
that's good preservation, right?
That's great. Preservation of the ethic has evolved so much.
It's crazy.
No, we figured it out. We're right, too. Yeah.
And it's the reversibility.
Yeah.
It's all of this.
We might be wrong.
I could be fallible. I could be totally wrong and off base on this. Let me make sure that my work can be reversed if somebody later on gets more research and says, "Wow, that was wildly off base."
Yeah.
Like some of the Chandler stuff.
So
like
talk about fireplace and, about the lighting real quick, because I saw in one of the notes that brass lights were brought in four or five years after.
Yeah, one parishioner paid for the chandeliers to come in.
These two things, these or two the sconces, or
the,
just
the two chandeliers were the big ones that were brought in by a single parishioner. He raised the funds to purchase.
Do you know if these are original?
I don't know if these are the original chandeliers. They're very similar, and if you look at that Wren Church in Blackfriars, there are chandeliers that look really close to these in that church.
Cool. And are those cherubs up there? One. Are those original as well?
The four statues?
Yeah.
The four statues are original. Yeah.
Wow.
Those were there. The church.
Is that right?
The clock was made by a local carpenter that also made the galleries up above, and he helped create and carve the four figures that were up there.
That's really cool.
Very cool.
I would not have guessed that.
I wouldn't have guessed that either.
Yeah.
And then when did the organ come in?
The organ, oh man, it's in my notebook. That's the second organ.
Is that 19th century?
No, it's
this organ might be 19th century. The first organ was here before the end of the 18th century.
Really? Can you imagine the acoustics of that thing in here?
It's pretty amazing.
Like, it was just blasts.
It's played. We'll come back in May when somebody hopefully graduates, and it'll get played for you.
I will.
Fingers crossed.
we have a piano graduate that comes back every year and plays the organ.
Oh, that's really cool. Because that's the graduation's here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, North Bend Street graduation's here.
That's awesome.
At this building.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, you'll be sitting, the graduates sit in the box pews along the main aisle, and then, and some on the outside, some of these pews out here, and then families sit in the outer box pews and in the galleries.
That's cool.
Maybe we'll see you here one day.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Hopefully it's not a warm day. It's a bit rough if it's a warm day.
Yeah. Thanks for watching this episode of the Passion for Craft podcast. We'll see you in the next one.